Ladies and gentlemen, the Rhode Island Jewish Historical Society is pleased to present an oral history with Mr. Kenneth Block, a software engineer from Barrington, who has entered the world of Rhode Island politics. Mr. Block ran for governor of Rhode Island 2 years ago, and he has just announced his candidacy for the year 2014. We are delighted to introduce Mr. Kenneth Block. A warm welcome to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm happy to tell you, Ken, that your oral history will join two Jewish governors Rhode Island has had. Are you a native Rhode Islander?
I am not. I grew up in Milford, Connecticut.
And tell us about growing up in Milford, Connecticut.
I was one of three siblings. Lived with my parents in a house that my mother's father built from scratch. And it had very many additions built on it over the years. Had a very happy childhood in Milford. My father was a biology professor at the University of Bridgeport, and my mother was a visiting nurse, an occupational therapist.
And would you tell us why you came to Rhode Island?
I almost ended up here by accident. I came to take a consulting job. I'm a software engineer by trade. I took a consulting job with GTEC in 1991. And I never left.
And how did it happen that your career in Rhode Island has been, for the most part, in computers?
So I, very early on in my life, I recognized I had a real affinity for computer science and working with computers. My uncle gave me one of the very first Apple computers. And I used it in high school. I realized it's what I wanted to do for a living. When I went to Dartmouth College, I took computer science. That was my major, along with a heavy dose of government and political science courses. And I have worked with computers ever since.
Now, you formed your own business, and you called it Simpatico Software. Tell us about that period in your career.
So, GTEC, I helped GTEC build one of the country's first food stamp computer systems in 1994. I was a full-time employee of GTEC at the time, and GTEC won contracts to do the food stamp systems in Texas and California and Illinois. In 1997, GTEC decided to leave that business, and they asked me to start a company to take over the software requirements for those contracts. And that was how Simpatico Software was born. I created the company to take over the food stamp contracts that GTEC no longer wanted to service.
Now, I hear software and hardware all the time. What does that mean? What do those two words mean in the computer world?
So the hardware is the physical computer itself. It's the casing of the computer and the brains inside the computer. The software is like verbal language. The software is what makes the computer run. And you can choose different language and different instructions to cause the computer to do different things. So a single piece of computer hardware can do an infinite number of things if the software is written to make those things happen. So that's the best explanation I can give you for the difference between those two.
Now, how long have you been in Rhode Island?
I've lived here since 1991.
Well, that's how many years?
So I'm now here 23 years.
Well, then in those years, you've certainly gotten to know the smallest state in the union.
Very much so, and there's no better way to learn a state than to be a candidate for statewide office like I was in 2010 when I drove every inch of this state and met people in every corner of the state.
Now, you started your own party.
Correct.
And you called it the Moderate Party. Why did you choose the word moderate? And what's moderate about your political aspirations?
So, the word moderate is a political descriptor. Individuals in Washington, D.C., politicians, and in my opinion, this is not a happy fact, a decreasing number of politicians are identified as moderates, either moderate Democrats or moderate Republicans. And the idea behind that descriptor is that it's somebody who's not driven by ideological extremes in terms of how they govern and the choices that they make. I am a committed political centrist. I believe that the best governance doesn't come from the political extremes of either political party, but it really comes from the political middle. And I believe the most effective politicians of our time have been those politicians who are closer to the political center rather than further away from it. And my whole thought process behind starting the Moderate Party was to provide a home for politically centered politicians to come to try to be pragmatic in terms of how they govern, and to know that there's a comfortable home where you can be moderate and not have that be a bad thing. In Washington, D.C. right now, moderates are a very rare bird because the two-party political system really breeds political extremism. The far right and the far left really control the selection process in terms of what kinds of candidates the parties get right now. And I think that's a mistake. So the word moderate was very carefully chosen in terms of how to describe this party, because this country needs moderates and pragmatists and individuals who can reach consensus to get things done. It's crucially necessary, and we don't have it. And I will say, though, that there's very little that's moderate in terms of what I have had to do, the fight I've had to go through to create this political party. I was required to jump through monumental hoops to create this political party and to put it on solid footing.
Did you ever think that you would run for governor of Rhode Island?
Never. That was not in my thought process. In terms of politics, I really felt strongly about creating the party. I felt that when the party got created, candidates would come. They'd be attracted to the idea. What I didn't understand at the time when I created the political party was the fight that was necessary to create the party. The politicians in Rhode Island over the last 20 years created a very unfair system that was designed to make starting a new party pretty much impossible. And it turns out they did such a good job at making it impossible that it was actually unconstitutional. When I discovered how hard it was, I contacted the ACLU, and they agreed with me that several of Rhode Island's laws were beyond onerous, and they had crossed over into unconstitutional. And we had to take the state to federal court, and we sued them over a law in particular that addressed how a political party is born. And the judge agreed with us that the law was unconstitutional. He struck it down. And it was only because of that court decision that the party was able to be born. By the time we fought that fight and made it through the court system, we were then faced with the burden of collecting, as a percentage of the population, one of the country's highest number of signatures to qualify the political party. We turned in 34,000 signatures to create the moderate party of Rhode Island. Once all of that was done, we were so close to the election that I couldn't bring a quality known candidate in to run for governor because too much time had gone by, all the other candidates had raised too much money, and all of the established politicians didn't want to be disadvantaged in terms of starting so late with a brand new party that nobody knew. My executive committee looked at me in February of 2010, a mere 9 months from the election, and said, "Ken, we think you should run for governor." And after I got back on my chair after having fallen off it and talking extensively to my wife, who required a lot of convincing, I became an accidental candidate for governor. It was not in my plans. I run two businesses. I have two young children. So the time to... I didn't have the required free time to run for governor. I made all the time. And frankly, probably the only reason I said yes was I didn't realize how hard it was. So I was the perfect candidate in not understanding any of those things.
Now, you mentioned your family. How do they feel about your life in the political world?
My children are very excited about my existence in the Rhode Island political arena. They love seeing newspaper articles about me. They love seeing when I'm on television. And they're truly tuned in to political issues. It's really fun to see. I have a 9 and a 10-year-old. And they are very up to speed on political issues. We have some extraordinary conversations at the dinner table. One of my current activities is I've taken a strong interest in trying to help Rhode Island eliminate the master lever from the ballot. And my children are experts on the master lever, as an example. So it's really fun. I've lectured to both of their social studies classes. There's a great many social studies teachers across the state who've had me come in and talk about what we're doing with the moderate party. And I think it's great. I think that involvement in politics is a necessary component of being a resident of this country. And I think paying attention to civics and understanding how the political system works and what the structure of our government looks like is crucially important.
At this point, having lived in Rhode Island for many years, what's the biggest dream that you have for the state?
So I'm a very, maybe even potentially overly logical person. When I look at problems, I try to look for what the root cause of those problems are. And as a resident of Rhode Island, as a business owner of two startup businesses in this state, as a taxpayer, as the father of school-aged children. So I'm a very logical, in fact, there's some folks who would say I'm an overly logical person when it comes to assessing what's wrong with Rhode Island and what we need to fix. And as a father of school-age children, as the owner of two businesses in this state, as a taxpayer, and as somebody who just pays attention in general, what I've determined are the problems are we have an economy that has wound down. So I've looked carefully at Rhode Island, and I've asked myself the question, what are the big problems in this state? And as the father of school-aged children, as the owner of two businesses in this state, as somebody who pays attention to politics and is a taxpayer in a great many different ways, I think that the two biggest problems that we have are an underperformance of our educational system, a situation where far too many of our school-aged children are underserved by the schools. And there are some statistics that, for me, are truly horrifying. At the Community College of Rhode Island, 70% of incoming freshmen with Rhode Island high school diplomas come in with either a fifth grade reading or mathematics capability. Fifth grade. And they require remediation.
That's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. And I grew up in a household where educational issues and a quality education were paramount. I went to public schools in Milford, Connecticut. My father was a professor of biology. My mother was the product of a lot of schooling. And I appreciate, and it was instilled in me, how important it was to take academics seriously and to excel at it. And I look at what we're doing now, and I look at how Rhode Island performs relative to other states. And it pains me that we underperform even our regional neighbors. Massachusetts schools are considered to be far superior than Rhode Island schools. And there isn't a strong reason for it, because if you ask most realtors in the Providence area where the best school systems are within a 20-mile radius of Providence, they'll tell you it's Sharon, Massachusetts. They won't say Barrington, and they won't say East Greenwich. They say Sharon, Massachusetts. And that's a problem that we should have. And it turns out that 15 years ago, Massachusetts undertook a top-to-bottom set of reforms inside their schools. They were one of the worst-performing states in the country, and now they're near the top. And Rhode Island needs to do the same thing, because we have to be competitive, and we have to make sure, most importantly, that our children get quality educations, because that is one of the best predictors for future success in life. And we failed to do it.
Is there any explanation for the fact that it wasn't done before?
Politics. It's political.
Well, how did that play a role in this?
So, Rhode Island's political system is one that's geared much more strongly to maintaining the status quo than towards making necessary changes. There are tremendous forces at play in Rhode Island to just keep things the way they are. And they're called special interests. And they have an outsized impact on the decisions that our elected political leaders make. But common sense says we must do things differently. If our schools compare so poorly relative to Massachusetts, common sense says we must take action to change that dynamic. And the most frustrating thing for me, one of the reasons I'm now involved in politics, has been watching this dysfunction and watching this reluctance to change the status quo. The status quo is not good enough. It's nowhere near good enough when we lag so spectacularly next
now,
to our neighbors.
How would you go about doing this?
Well, the changes are actually underway. We have a new education commissioner in this state who has implemented a number of necessary changes. And by the way, if you look at what we're doing now in Rhode Island and what was done 15 years ago in Massachusetts, they're very similar changes. So we know we have a blueprint for what worked well in Massachusetts. And what we need to do now is we need to execute, and we need to make that happen. You asked me a second question, though. You asked me about two things there were. And I told you about education, and the other equally important, and by the way, completely interlinked with the educational issue, is an economic one. Rhode Island is not a competitive place to own a business. And too many business owners will look at Rhode Island and look at Massachusetts and decide that Massachusetts is a better place to set up their business. Rhode Island only has 38,000 businesses. It's a very small economy. There are some people who would argue that it's too small. We can't afford to shrink much more. We need to add jobs. We need to add businesses. And we need to be competitive. The reason we struggle economically, the reason we don't have as many jobs as we would like, is largely because we don't compare well to Massachusetts and Connecticut in terms of a place to do business there as opposed to doing business here. So it's a basic comparative problem, and there's some fairly simple solutions to comparing better, but all of these solutions require political will to change the status quo and apply some common sense logic. And those are the things that I feel are 100% lacking in our elected leaders, and certainly the evidence says it's been lacking for a long time here. And I submit that it's time to think differently and to tackle these problems head on and fix them, because the status quo is not acceptable.
Why do you think you're the best person for the position that you're looking for?
I believe I'm the best candidate for governor of Rhode Island because I bring a set of skills and a worldview into that office that the other candidates don't have. Most of the other candidates are administrators. They've been mayors. They have performed jobs like that. What we need is vision inside the governor's office. We need a governor willing to pick up the bully pulpit of that office and drive the conversation in the state. We have to drive the conversation on the need for education reform and what specific things we need to do to achieve that reform. We need a governor who understands economic development, not simply how to spell it, but how to do it. I have started 2 successful businesses in my career. I've worked with the venture communities in terms of raising capital, and I understand very well what's broken with our economy and what we need to do to fix it. And I've spent a good portion of the last 2 years talking about, with our current elected leaders, ideas and things that we need to do to fix our economy. Vision, the ability to communicate that vision, and the application of common sense in how we fix things is what makes me so different from all the other candidates.
How can you spend so much time away from your business and concentrating on the campaign?
So I've always been a multitasker, and I am multitasking with great regularity these days. I have a very, very competent staff in my businesses, and I'm able to let them run the businesses without a lot of need for me to micromanage what they do. So right now, my role in my business is administrative, and it is marketing, because we are selling our services all over the country right now. But as far as the day-to-day operation, I don't need to be highly involved in what that is.
And you can spend hours asking friends and strangers for money.
That is how I'm spending my days right now. And let me just say that I can't think of a sillier way for a politician to spend his or her time than asking citizens for donations. Because if you think about it, the concept of asking for money, first of all, presents the possibility of a quid pro quo, which we really don't want our politicians to be facing. But much more importantly, this idea that raising money makes someone a strong candidate has no bearing on the kind of job that candidate may or may not do if they happen to win the office. The best fundraiser is not necessarily going to be the best elected official. But yet, we have a selection process where the fundraising has a very large percentage of importance in terms of who wins. And I think it's broken and it's backwards. The hundreds upon hundreds and thousands of hours that candidates for statewide office spend on raising money, wouldn't that time be better spent if all that time was spent proposing solutions for how to fix the problem? And I think it's a shame that our political system has gone where it is, but the reality is that's the system that we have right now. So yes, I am engaged in spending many hours a day asking for money.
I'm very interested in how you feel about gun control.
So my gut reaction to the Connecticut school shootings was that stronger gun control is probably necessary. That was my initial gut reaction when it happened. And as I've had a chance to let it simmer and think about it a little bit, I believe very strongly that background checks, additional background checks, especially linked with mental health, needs to be happening here. We need to make sure that the guns that are in circulation and new guns are that it's as difficult as possible for the wrong people to have it show up in their hands. Should there be, or phrased differently, would additional limitations in terms of the types of guns that are manufactured make a big difference in terms of what's happening out there right now? I don't know. I haven't had the chance to do the research to understand that. But I believe at the end of the day that we start with what we can do that we know will make a difference, and I believe that that start is with background checks.
Tell us how you would handle a massive problem. An example, a tornado that Oklahoma just had. A hurricane. Tell us how you would work to keep the state working back to normalcy as fast as possible.
So much would depend on what became broken as a result of that catastrophe. But I think that Rhode Island has a fairly good process in place in terms of preparation for a disaster like a hurricane. And the key to any of these disasters, if you have forewarning of them, is preparation. And so I've seen the state of Rhode Island react fairly well recently to approaching storms. And, you know, as governor, I would want to make sure that we continued with the advanced preparation as much as we can, because the most important thing is to prevent the loss of life.
Do you have any role model in taking on the job of governor?
I'm a fan of Bill Clinton. I've always liked how he positioned himself in terms of on the political spectrum. He was truly a centrist. He was able to work across the aisle and got compromise. And that's what I look for in my political heroes. And there are a number of very effective elected leaders that have been able to do the same thing. Michael Bloomberg is one of them, mayor of New York City. And there's not enough of them, unfortunately. But that's who I'm attracted to, and that's who I like.
What do you think the most important job would be in being governor?
The governor of Rhode Island is constitutionally weak. And what I mean by that is that the legislature has more of the balance of power sits with the legislature than it does with the governor's office. So what the governor has is the ability to move public opinion and effectively use the bully pulpit. That's what I haven't seen a governor do effectively here for some time, and that's what's missing. We don't have an elected leader using the office of the governor to drive the conversation and to be the genesis of the ideas necessary to fix what is broken. The legislature is not the place for a lot of innovation. The ideas have to be brought to the legislature, and the governor's office is the place to do that. And that's what I would concentrate on as governor of Rhode Island.
Tell us about a recent project or problem that you had, and you made it better, made it faster, more efficient, less expensive.
So I have two different anecdotes to tell you. On the political side, I decided to take a look at Rhode Island's unemployment insurance fund, because nationally we have the most expensive unemployment insurance fund of all 50 states. And I asked the common sense question, why is this? And I asked for data from the government so I could begin to look at it. And what I quickly realized was that the deficit that Rhode Island has run in our unemployment insurance fund, $500 million deficit is how big it was driven almost exclusively by a small set of businesses. 4,000 out of 38,000 businesses were responsible for the deficit. And a lot of these businesses were repeat users of our unemployment insurance fund. They laid people off, the same people, year after year after year after year. And that's not what the fund was designed to do. And once I realized this, I realized additionally that 34,000 businesses pay into that fund to help subsidize the business operations of a very small number of businesses. So it's patently unfair, and it's economically ruinous, because we have such a high cost in our fund, and it makes us very uncompetitive with the rest of the country. I pointed this out to the governor's office and to the speaker's office, and the speaker very quickly understood that I was right, and he actually put together his own bill directing the Department of Labor and Training, which administers the unemployment insurance fund, to fix the problem. So that was a practical application of common sense and analysis. In my business, I'm in the business of helping state governments look at data to identify waste and fraud. That's what we do. And over the course of my working with the state of Texas, we helped the state of Texas wring more than $1 billion of waste and fraud out of their food stamp program. This is back in the mid-1990s. We are actively looking at different issues with the state of Rhode Island, and we are moving ever closer to beginning to do this work for several other states. There are tremendous efficiencies to be realized by paying close attention to how well or not well taxpayer dollars are being spent. And when you can discover that those dollars are being misspent, the quicker you can correct that problem, the more money that you save everybody all the way around, and most importantly, you make sure that your dollars are being well spent.
Tell us about a time when things didn't go the way you wanted, like a project that didn't turn out how you had hoped that it would, and your vision, your dream was not fulfilled.
In business, that happens on a routine basis, and it's called the competitive procurement process. So we have been providing food stamp services to the state of Texas for many, many years. And they went out to bid recently, and we were not the low bidder on the project. So what's important when you get a dose of bad news like that is ensuring that any number of pieces of bad news are not enough to throw your whole operation off kilter or shut you down. So when there's bad news, whether it's as a state or as a business owner or even in your family, it's important to have backup plans and to have not have all your eggs in one basket. And that's how I've organized my business. That's how I believe the state needs to be organized. You need to have multiple irons in the fire, and you have to be prepared and assume that you're going to get your fair share of bad news, that it's not, that certain things aren't going to work out the way you want them to, and you'd better have additional ideas and plans in place so that you get some wins alongside with some of your losses.
On May 22nd, 2013, you announced that you would run for the second time for governor of Rhode Island. You have more political experience this year than you did 2 years ago. There are more problems than there were 2 years ago. There are economic problems, serious ones. People are leaving the state. The economy is worse than it was 2 years ago. As governor, what would you do at this moment?
The governor has to do a great many things all at once. And that's one of the reasons that my multitasking makes me a particularly good fit for the job. As governor, immediately the first order of business is taking steps to improve Rhode Island's competitiveness with other states and to instill confidence in our economy. Economies are driven by confidence. When there's high levels of confidence, there's economic expansion. And when there's a lack of confidence, there's a contraction. And when there's a gross level of lack of confidence, you get a depression. We are in our own mini depression in Rhode Island because the majority of business owners have no confidence that Rhode Island will get its act together to be economically competitive. As governor, my first priority, among several priorities, is to take actions to rebuild confidence in our economy. At the same time, we have to continue and push for the necessary educational reforms to make our schools more competitive, and most importantly, to get far better educational outcomes for our children. We should not, as a society, see 70% of our community college matriculants come in needing remediation. That number has to drop radically and as fast as we can. Because if we produce underachievers like that as a matter of course in this state, what does the future hold for us?
The state has officially recognized the moderate party. In 2013, you are now a candidate for governor. What will you be saying to the people of Rhode Island?
I believe it's incumbent on all Rhode Island politicians to apply, first and foremost, common sense to the problems that we see. Are we spending money wisely? Is the money that's being spent achieving its intended purpose? And if it isn't, we need to fix that. It's the most important function of government, and it's one that Rhode Island has not done well ever since I moved here. I moved here during the credit union crisis. That was my introduction to the Rhode Island economy. Again, a gigantic crisis in confidence brought about by gross negligence.
Was that the problem that Bruce Sutherland had?
Correct. Absolutely correct. And Governor Sundlun took very specific steps to reinstill confidence and fix the problem. And that's what we need here right now. All of our economic issues are fixable. In fact, there isn't a problem we've discussed today that isn't fixable. Rhode Island can be fixed. It's fixable. And it's worth fixing. The problem has been a lack of political will. And frankly, the voters of this state haven't taken matters into their own hands to say, enough is enough. We want the monkey business to stop. And we want to see this state run professionally. And we want to see this state excel and rise up from where it is right now. It is achievable. The problems are fixable. They're definable. They're understandable. We just haven't done a good job getting it done. It has to change because the status quo in this state is not acceptable.
Well, Governor, we want you to know that we thank you for this conversation. We thank you for making all this information available to the Rhode Island Jewish Historical Society and for those people fortunate enough to listen to you on this day. We wish you good fortune, and if elected, we are confident you will. You will be one of the outstanding governors of Rhode Island. Is there anything that you would like to say in closing? We thank you, incidentally, for this great conversation we've just had, and I hope that our next conversation, I will address you as Governor Block.
Well, I want to thank you for spending the time to chat with me tonight. I've always enjoyed all of the histories that you've taken that I've heard. I'm honored to be chosen to provide this oral history to you, and I look forward to sitting down with you again as governor to talk about any issue that you would like to address and get it down on tape.
And I would look forward to that great, great moment.
Thank you.
Thank you.